The sign held outside the Torneo Texas Migrant Children Detention Center read, "I need to be able to tell my children I did not stay silent." Lynn Silver was standing witness at that center. Let's hear from Lynn Silver from her own eyes, next on Through the Eyes of Women. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program featuring the lives and perspectives of women, local, national, and international. As I sit here in the KHSU studio, it is a wall that dominates the news and social media. Since early May, 2,342 children have been separated from their parents after crossing the southern U.S. border, according to the Department of Homeland Security, as part of a new immigration strategy by the Trump administration that has prompted widespread outcry. In June of last year, President Trump signed an executive order reversing his policy of separating families and replacing it with a policy of detaining entire families together, including children, but ignoring legal time limits on the detention of minors. After all these months, there are still estimated to be over 200 children still in federal custody separated from their parents. In the last 5 years, the tens of thousands of people from Central America crossed into the U.S. through the Rio Grande Valley sector. This humanitarian crisis is such because these refugees are fleeing violence and/or poverty. Around our planet, millions of people are fleeing their homes because of war, genocide, drug cartels, gangs, abuse, economics, climate change. What they have in common is they are hungry, scared, exhausted, in a foreign land, have nothing but the clothes on their back and wait for something better to happen in their lives. I'm your host today on Through the Eyes of Women. I'm Brenda Starr, and my guest today on the phone is Lynn Silver, living in Texas, who is going to share her tale of the rise and fall of the tent city for migrant children in Torneo, Texas, from her own eyes. Welcome, Lynn, and thank you for bringing your experience to our listening audience.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, I want to start by, would you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, my gosh. I was raised in Montgomery, Alabama. My dad was very good friends with the then Governor Wallace. I was raised to be, I guess, what you'd call a fundamentalist. I was with my dad when the Freedom Riders came through at the Greyhound Station. My dad took me over to see all the Freedom Riders, you know, bloody and beaten up. And he said to me, "I want you to remember this day for the rest of your life, because this is what happens when people not from our community come in and tell us how to live." I remember the governor, it was Governor Patterson at the time, refused to allow the Freedom Riders to have any medical care whatsoever. They were left there to just survive on their own. I was there when martial law was declared by President Kennedy. We were driving around in town. We weren't supposed to be, but my dad drove us over to the First Baptist Church where Dr. King was having a service. Outside the church, all the cars in the parking lot were on fire. There were people fighting in the streets, men with billy clubs. It was just a nightmare. My dog was killed that night, and this is my first introduction to social injustice.
Pretty big one.
Yeah. You know, later on, my dad was promoted and transferred to Washington, D.C., and he worked at the Pentagon. And right out of high school, I was able to get a civil service job having to do with the Vietnam War. I had a position with a top secret clearance, and I was processing secret documents. You know, I would read all the material that was there, and I was totally in shock because all the information was not the information that was disseminated to the public and on the news. What I saw was the real truth. I was working with hostile fire pay and the reality of the Vietnam War. So it really, after living through the civil rights movement and, you know, being a part of the Vietnam War, it was pretty devastating. And my social circle at that time was with people who had been injured in Vietnam. And I had a group of friends who were all in wheelchairs, and we used to party together. And It was really devastating to hear all their stories. And my first boyfriend was paraplegic, and he would die a year later after I had met him. But the really cool thing is we would go out dancing the nightclubs, and him being in a wheelchair, some of the nightclubs like, no, you can't come in. You take up too much room. We don't want you here. And he would say, I'm coming in. You know, I have a right to be here. Given all that, I think that set the groundwork for my being an advocate for social justice. So then when, over the years, I've been in several demonstrations against, you know, various wars and whatever. But then when I saw the children in the cages in McAllen, something went crazy in me. I thought, this is not happening in my country, in my state of Texas. I was in disbelief. So I went down to McAllen with a group of grannies from New York and all over the United States, a group of grannies protesting. And it was a peaceful, it was very peaceful. And what we ended up doing was being able to connect with the Catholic charities there where the migrants were housed. We got to actually talk to them, hug them, sing to them, and cry with them. And what I learned was when ICE picks up these people and drops them off at the bus station, they take everything from them, even their shoelaces. They have nothing. So they're left to be, you know, on their own. So thank goodness there are charities that help. And to actually talk with them and to be up close to them was really a life-changing event for me. The group of us that were together, we sang to them. And, of course, I'm sure they didn't understand our songs. But the smiles that were there, it was like time stood still because we were all one together.
Music transformed that and showed your love.
It was amazing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, soon it was over and we're back to the reality of what's going on. So some of the people, you know, were going on buses, you know, different places. There was one guy there, the local guy. He was in a wheelchair and he had been a Border Patrol agent and gotten injured. He alone was the welcoming committee for all these immigrants coming in. And he volunteered. He was not being paid. And I walked over and asked him, I said, why are you doing this? And he said, how can I not? How can I not care for these people who are coming in here? Fast forward to Tornilla. Tornilla is in the Chihuahuan Desert near El Paso. And I first saw where these children who were aged 13 to 17, who had come to the Border Patrol to ask for asylum. All these children came alone, and they had points of contact in the United States, either their parents or sponsors. So they had done their homework, and they were prepared to, once they asked for asylum, to go stay with their family members. But in turn, they were sent to Tornilla, which is a concentration camp. It's a prison. And they were sent there not knowing anything. I went down for 4 days, and I spent time with Joshua Rubin, who is the gentleman who had been there for 3 months scoping out the place. And it's a tent city. I think there were 15 tents. The children were housed in those tents. And when they needed to go to the bathroom or to take a shower, a makeshift shower, they were single file walking out to that and then watched walking back to the tent. All the fences there had black tarps put over them, so there was no communication. My friends and I sat out in front of the toll plaza there, which was the entrance to Tornilla. And we held up signs for 4 days from dawn to dusk, and we watched what was going on. the buses that brought the kids in and out had paper over the windows. They could not see what was going on. If anyone around came near any of the buildings, there were helicopters overhead, and there were patrol cars following us. It was only three of us there at the time. It was like, oh, man, there's a helicopter up there watching us. And along the fence line to Tornilla, I was walking around just trying to check out the place. And I walked the fence line, and there was a patrol car, security car, rather, on the other side following me. So I went to the entrance, and I just stood there, and car was on the other side. We sort of had a stare down, and I just stood there and waved at him. And then I thought, well, I'll go back to where I began this, right, to the toll booth. And he went his way. And then I thought, an hour later, I'm going to try it again. So I walked out there again. There was a security car following me with his lights on. And the security car, of course, was inside the fence, and I was outside the fence. The whole ordeal was so top secret. It was incredible. We were told that the people who worked there had not had the clearances that they're supposed to. Tornilla was classified as an emergency facility.
What does that mean? That means you have to have a special clearance?
There's no surveillance. There's no, they answer to no one. Okay, the contract was the Baptist Children and Family Services, BCFS. They had a contract with the federal government.
With the Office of Refugees Resettlement, the ORR?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so there was no accountability because it's a contractor working for, you know, on federal property. There was no state of Texas intervention or no accountability from the state of Texas. So they had carte blanche on whatever they wanted to do. So we were really concerned about the welfare of the kids. I know when Joshua Rubin went around to the soccer field where the kids were playing when he first got there. He was there for 3 months. He just now returned to New York.
Yeah, he's a software developer.
Software developer who had no hidden agenda whatsoever. He saw what was going on and said, I've got to go down there and see, you know, what I can do to make this better. When he first got there, there were no tarps on the fences. When he first got there, he was talking to the kids, and all the security came around and stopped him. And immediately after that, that's when the tarps were put up.
Wow.
Immediately. So everything was so secret about what was going on there. And we still don't know why it had to be that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Through the Eyes of Women here on KHSU. I'm your host, Brenda Starr, and my guest is Lynn Silver, who's traveled to Tornillo, Texas, to demonstrate against the jail in Tent City that has held children who have crossed the U.S. border since May of 2018 and have been separated from their families, from her own eyes. Now, Lynn, what you describe here, you know, because a lot of people say, well, it's the incarceration of children. It's not, we haven't seen this since the World War II internment of Japanese Americans.
Right.
But you describe it more like a concentration camp and almost as when the mafia puts, you know, bags over people's heads and takes them
right
out of town. I want to talk a little bit, if you can, about the ORR, because there's a similarity between what they're doing and the prison system, our prison industrial complex,
right,
that we've seen for the last 20, 30 years. Talk about that similarity with the secrecy and everything.
Well, the secrecy, I think, was exposed as it should be. Joshua was there for 3 months, and then more people started going down to peacefully protest. And it was emphasized peacefully because we were so afraid if anything happened, the children would suffer from that. You know, the guards or the people in charge would take it out on them. So we were so careful to be very polite, I know I was walking down a county road trying to get to the soccer field, and one of the BCFS security guards stopped me, and he said, "Ma'am, what are you doing?" I said, I'm just taking a walk. How are you?" He says, "You know you're on private property." I said, "No, I know I'm on a county road, and I have a right to be here." And he says, "Ma'am, you're on private property," just like that. And wow. So I said, "Okay." So I turned around and went back. I didn't want to cause any problems. We were, like I said, we were there peacefully. That really bothered me because the day before, news media and Joshua had been down that same road and told me that it was a county road, and, you know, many people had been there. So I think maybe because I was a single grandmother by myself.
You could be easily intimidated, you know, if someone wanted to intimidate.
Yeah. I turned around and went back. But that's the type of surveillance that was going on there. And I still want to know why. I mean, mm-hmm. Tornillo's shutting down. They say that these children are being sent to their parents or sponsors. And I think there's like 200 of them that didn't have sponsors. And I think they're being relocated to other detention centers. But we cannot get any firm information on that. We don't know.
It's like having that top secret clearance again. You've got to, you have to know that information, don't you?
And after I got back from Tornillo, 2 days later, a group of us demonstrated at the BCFS headquarters in San Antonio, and they had a spokeswoman come out and try to, you know, explain what was going on. This was televised. It's Move On, I think, televised it, and it's several other stations that recorded this. The spokeswoman, I asked her, I said, "Why are there tarps over the fences? Why is everything so secretive?" And she says, "Well, we don't want, that's for the safety of the children."
Hmm.
And then she went on to say there was a man who threatened the children, and we were concerned for their welfare. Well, what she was referring to, pretty sure, is when Joshua was there and he was talking with the kids and trying to get out, you know, find information.
Right. I saw a picture of the facility, and sometimes they were out there playing soccer.
Yes.
And through a fence that maybe you could communicate with, and maybe that's what they were referring to, is Joshua was doing that.
Yes, but immediately, like I said, the tarps were up, and after that, there was no communication. And anybody that even came around when they were playing soccer after that, the kids were called in.
Sounds more like a Guantanamo or even or some prison on an island. Now, you mentioned that you stood there and protested with grannies and people that were like mind of you. Tell me what happened when the officials and the politicians came. Is that when the impetus to try to close the place started?
Actually, it was Beto and several Congress people came down. They reported what they had seen, and inside they said even though they got to tour the facility, they were not allowed to talk to the children. And they had to give a 2-week notice to the facility that they were coming.
2 weeks.
And ironically enough, the day before they came, there was a truck came in with shredding machines.
Boy, this is getting curious and curiouser.
Yeah, and that really happened. It was like, what is going on? So now, like I said, because of Joshua's efforts and other people that went there to demonstrate, to hold signs, to just be present, that worked. And they're in the process of shutting it down. I don't know where they are today with it.
Well, I think I think the last thing I read was there's 850 children still remaining, and that the tents at least are expected to be gone by the end of the
right.
month. So we really don't know what their timeline is, especially if everything is secret.
And I'd like to say that Baptist Children Family Services before this, from what I know, had a good reputation. But I think they were really anxious to shut it down. they were getting dollars a day per child. And it was averaging out, when I was there, it was $1 million a day, because there were like 3,000, right under 3,000 kids there. And that's what taxpayers were paying for this makeshift emergency place for these kids. And it's like, how in the heck can it be $1 million a day when they're in tents? And they have makeshift bathrooms and makeshift showers.
Well, one thing the government does very well, and I've noticed this when we changed welfare as we knew it, shortly after that, it wasn't just nonprofit organizations, community-based organizations that were going to do services for people. The government put out, and this was right after, quite honestly, right after George Bush took office, and there was a whole religious approach. Now, Catholic Charities have always helped people. The Baptist, they've always helped people. But then there became workshops for organizations, for religious organizations, to claim the same money, because the money was loosened up. They could get the same money to do services, and it has escalated, and it sounds like this is kind of the apex of it right now for children.
It is. And what's so ironic is the Baptist Children Family Services no longer call themselves that. They're now officially BCFS.
Oh.
Interesting, huh?
Well, you want to be an acronym either because it sounds easy or because you really want to hide what it says.
And I don't know if we'll ever find out what the treatment was of those children. But at least they're, hopefully, from what we hear, they're on their way to their families and sponsors, except for the ones that didn't have family members.
Well, there's still over 200 children in federal custody that are separated from their parents.
Yeah, and these are kids 13 through 17 that came on this journey by themselves. It's just amazing.
So were you able to share stories with other people who had been there, who were able to see the children, or was it just Joshua that was able to maybe?
Joshua is the only one that had any contact with those kids, and that's when he was first there and talked to them. And like I said, if you go to Facebook to Witness Tornia, there's a video of him talking to them, and then immediately they put up the tarps. So there was no communication whatsoever, no contact with the outside world. Like I said, the buses had their windows papered over, blacked out. So the kids had no knowledge of anything. The only communication they had was to write on a soccer ball, write their names on a soccer ball, and throw it over the fence. And some of the people still have those soccer balls with the kids' names on them.
Wow. Now, were the officials and politicians, what Beto O'Rourke, you said, was there, who was instrumental in wagging a finger at the situation, were they able to see the children?
Yeah, they toured the facility.
Okay,
they went in and toured it. Like I said, they had to give them a two-week notice. And then they arrived and they toured the facility, but they were not allowed to interact with the children.
Wow. Lynn, you've sent me a lot of pictures, and I love the one that I couldn't tell my grandchildren that I just stood silent. Those were the sentiments of the people that were there. What did you learn about yourself from this experience?
Well, I learned all of my childhood experiences and things that I have, learned in my life. It all exploded. It just exploded. I knew I had to be there. Not that I could do anything, but I had to be there and bear witness. And the people that came, it wasn't a whole lot of people, but it was enough people to make a difference. And knowing Joshua Rubin, I spent 4 days with him there in the desert, and we were holding up signs all day from dusk to dawn, and it was cold, and it was, not friendly. But what I learned is this, through him, and he was never blaming anybody. He says, we've got to concentrate on the welfare of these children. And through his peaceful, protest, and other people, change did come about. It's amazing how quickly it happened. Because like I said, he was there for 3 months. It's amazing what one person can do when other people join and stick together. Another thing I'd like to add is the Border Patrol and the people who worked in Tornillo were so supportive, and I know that sounds crazy, but when we would hold up the signs and wave, they waved back, and they would give us a high sign, or people would blow their horns, and it was so refreshing.
Well, you touch their humanity, too, you know,
with
you and other people going, people who are strangers who come together, you touch their humanity as well. So what's next for you in your advocacy?
I'm going to wait and see what happens. I'm hoping that things improve, but if I need to go back to the border, I'm definitely doing it.
And how far do you live from there?
Oh, about 8 hours.
Bless your heart.
No, a friend of mine has been 4 or 5 times. She's just, you know, she's such an advocate. It was the children. Seeing the children in the cages did it for so many people.
Well, I want to thank you for what you share. You can follow Lynn Silver. That's LynnSilver, Lynn Silver on Facebook. You have a wonderful piece that you wrote called Bone Cold, and I'd love people to go there to see it. And then you also mentioned, what was the Tornillo site that you wanted?
Witness Tornillo, and it's on Facebook, and it's Tornillo.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Lynn, for being our guest, for sharing your stories, for being an advocate, for standing cold, for standing ground for those who can't. You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I've been your host, Brenda Starr, and I've been speaking with Lynn Silver, who shared her stories about the rise and fall of the Tornillo, Texas Detention Center for Migrant Children. For more information about Lynn and her account, you can visit her Facebook, Lynn Silver. Through the Eyes of Women is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University. Thanks to today's engineer and editor, Jessica Eden, and to the entire Through the Eyes of Women team. To listen to this program again, visit the KHSU archives, or our blog at khsuwomen.com, where you can also learn more about the show and post listener comments. Join us again next Monday at 1:30 right here on KHSU.